Hi, and welcome to episode 4 of the Philosophy and Film podcast, brought to you by the Hyde Park Picture House in Leeds. My name's Joe Saunders. I'm a philosopher at Durham University, and for the past few years, I've run a regular philosophy and film series at the Picture House. With the cinema closed and screenings not currently possible, we thought we'd give a podcast a go as a way of continuing some of the interesting discussions we've already begun, as well as to start some exciting new ones. For this Valentine's Day, we're joined by philosopher Alison Toop from the University of Leeds to explore love in the 2015 film The Lobster. With meeting in person still not possible, I spoke with Alison over Zoom last week. Hi, Alison. So, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
I feel like it was a couple of years ago now that you showed The Lobster at the Picture House, and there was a really interesting Q&A with the audience.
Yeah, I couldn't work this out earlier. I think it's 2 years ago. Yeah.
I think it was my birthday, because my mum lives in New Zealand, but
she was there.
Yeah, she was over.
Yeah.
For the film, it was really nice. She came to see it, but well. So she has two strong preferences about films, and they are that films shouldn't really have any violence and they should have unambiguously happy endings. And so this was, this was not a good film for her. I'd never seen it before. So I heard it was a dark comedy. So I just showed up to watch it, obviously, hear what you had to say about it. But it was very difficult to watch, sitting next to my mum, kind of aware of how much she was not enjoying the film. She did like the talk, by the way. She really enjoyed the talk and discussion, just not the violence of the film.
Oh, take care. It's funny though. The violence never sticks with me, and I always like sometimes like the ending goes as well. Like, it's just a feeling that this film gives me that always sticks with me. Just like there's something about it, and it's definitely not the violence that's there. But when I rewatching it again this weekend, I was like, actually, this is really violent.
I kind of want to, well, there's lots of things to get into. So maybe it's best to just begin by asking you why you chose to show this film. Why The Lobster?
Yeah, why The Lobster? It's just a brilliantly interesting film. Like, it manages to be a completely classic love story whilst also being like a complete critique of norms and expectations that we have surrounding love. It's fun, it's quirky, it's just a little bit weird, but manages to actually provide quite a perceptive commentary, I think, on just sort of current society and current expectations we have about our own relationships, sort of both romantic ones and friendships, and how those fit into our society overall and how important they are.
Nice. So plenty to get into there. Just jumping back, just before, when we were discussing the violence in the film and how much my mum hated that, you kind of mentioned that that's not the feeling that the film leaves you with. And I was just curious as to what feeling the film does leave you with.
So I think it's a mixture, partly a kind of, oh, maybe love can kind of conquer all feeling. I still get a sort of upbeat feeling from it, even though it's really brutal in how they maintain it. There's something about that it's actually worth finding what the real essence of love is and what sort of the real importance of human relationships are throughout it. Like, it's still worth having this commentary on it and fighting for it.
Yeah, interesting. So if you do think the film's upbeat, what do you make of the final scene?
So, yeah, I guess this is a feeling that I get left with, but when you then think about, maybe this is why I always forget the final scene, is because it just doesn't fit into how I generally want to feel about the film. But it's, I guess it depends on whether you think he goes through with it or not, right? And I love how ambiguous that is, because whether they actually manage to realise that they love each other despite the fact that he isn't also blind, even though they can't find another common thing. That actually the fact that they've got this far, that he's willing to do it, seems to already suggest the love is still there, that it's not just suddenly disappeared, and so he doesn't actually need to go and blind himself and go through with it. Although perhaps, I mean, given the brutality of the film and everything else that happens, maybe we have to assume he really does go through with it. Then I guess it's just the sort of that they're really, there are people that really are willing to do the stuff for the people that they love, and that they will actually make sacrifices, and that there is an essence of humanity once you actually click and connect with someone, and how sort of strong and motivating that can be.
It is hard to watch that scene.
Mm.
Not only because, you know, it's looking like he's about to stab himself in the eye with a steak knife, which is not easy viewing, but it's also hard to watch because it does seem like a stupid idea. You're hoping they're going to end up together, and then you think, well, I guess I'm therefore also hoping he stabs himself in the eye, because the conception of love that they've subscribed to, that's the only way for it to realistically work. But that's kind of internal to the logic of their worlds. What you really want is for him to come out of the bathroom and go, hang on, I've thought about it, and actually we don't need to share this one distinctive feature. I don't need to stab myself in the eye. We can be different but still love each other. But it's hard to see that playing out in the logic of the world. In the world with the logic that that world has, you kind of think either he comes back in also blinded, or he comes back out and lies to her about it.
Actually, yeah, I hadn't kind of even thought of the lying option, but that's actually quite a theme through the film, so I think it is definitely something that we should, yeah, that is a possibility there. I think it's just such an interesting thought, isn't it? Because they've rejected like the general accepted norms of their society, right? So they were already loners, and they've managed to reject the loners' rules and society, and they've broke out. But just one step too far appears to be to actually question what it means to love someone.
Okay, so do you think there's anything that we could learn about the film that might help us view the film or think about the film from the world of philosophy, and in particular from the world of the philosophy of love?
Yeah, definitely. I think it uses, don't know whether deliberately or accidentally, quite a common theory of love, and plays with some of the common objections to that theory. So it aligns with the theory that thinks that love responds to properties in other people, and that these properties give reasons to love someone else. Now, these kinds of things we might typically think are sort of like looking for someone's sense of humour, or generally sort of whether, you know, these good properties they might have, whether they're good at art or intelligent or just generally a happy person to be around. And this theory opens to a number of objections, notably the worry that it seems that it'd be rational for people to trade up if they find someone that has a better version of that property. So, for instance, from the film, someone that has a bloodier nose or a greater, greater love of maths, or is just even more of a psychopath.
That's so good. So there's the scene with the guy who bashes his own nose. He says up on the stage that his father left his mother because he found someone who was better at maths, perhaps having a graduate degree, where yeah, his mother was only a undergraduate.
Yeah. So trading up is clearly something that happens. And I think there's like a reason why a lot of them are actually in the hotel. Because even the main character, so the first of lines that you hear are, does he wear glasses or contact lenses? And that line makes no sense in the context of the first opening scene if you're just watching it for the first time. But once you realise what's going on and rewatch it, you're sitting there like, aha, his wife has left him for another short-sighted person who is perhaps somehow better at being short-sighted, or is more short-sighted than he is. And he's clarifying that that is what has happened. But the other thing as well that this theory sort of tends to be rejected for is because there is a thought that love should remain despite changes in the other person. And this is another thing that the film just seems to play with. So It seems to be assumed that love can't remain if the common defining feature between the two people in the couple is lost in the film. So, for instance, when Rachel Weisz's character is blinded, it was immediately assumed that that would solve the issue, right? That if we stop her from being merely short-sighted and make her blind, then they can't love each other anymore because they haven't got this defining common feature. So she's changed so much that he can no longer love her because that reason to love her is no longer there.
Yeah, nice. So if a couple meets when they're relatively young and they meet running one of those really early runs, the park runs they do, that's one in Hyde Park. So they meet every Saturday, 9 a.m. and do a park run. They do the same, they run the kind of similar time together. They see each other every Saturday and one time they get a coffee afterwards and their love blossoms from that. And that's what they share, doing these early morning park runs. And love blossoms for that and it's a successful love. But it might happen over time that they no longer keep running individually or together. And it would be weird to think that the love could no longer exist because they're not doing the shared activity that caused them to fall in love.
Yeah, so this is sort of, I guess, where the film becomes a little ambiguous, but is where, this theory needs sort of teasing out. It's like, well, in that case, perhaps they change together. So maybe their common defining feature could just sort of coincidentally manage to stay similar. Well, we're people that always used to do park run, and we no longer are. I think the real problem comes is when one person stops doing it and the other continues. If this is what your love was based on and that is no longer there in one partner, then it supposedly fades away. Well, that's what in the film it suggests. But yeah, this is what sort of one worry of this sort of account is like, well, no, hang on, don't we love people even if they change, even if they no longer have those features that initially I found really attractive and was the reason that I fell in love with them in the first place?
So maybe a difficult question, or maybe I just didn't pay enough attention to the film while I was watching it. But if someone asked you why the two main characters fall in love, what would you say?
I guess they'd say because she's short-sighted. That seems to be the only thing that matters, is that they find a common thing. Whatever that trivial common thing seems to be. But it doesn't seem therefore to be sort of a falling in love. It seems to be more of a just a, oh, well, we must love each other because we have this common characteristic.
Is that, I mean, I think it feels like that's the reason they would give, or the answer they would give to the question of why they fell in love. But is that actually why they fell in love? So there's a kind of scene early on where she looks at him in a certain way, and I'm not sure if it's physical attraction or if there's just something that seems to draw them to each other. And then later on, they discover they have this shared characteristic, and they try and make something like love work, and it really does. And weirdly, and this is all kind of just like popping out of my head now, but I think like their genuine affection for each other comes out when they're playing at being in love at the parents' house with a weird guitar. So maybe there is something, you know, a genuine loving connection there, but they can only really make sense of it insofar as they have the shared characteristic. But there does seem to be something between them, some sort of spark.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense because you're right, there is a spark. So perhaps why they fell in love has got something to do with the fact that there were acts of kindness, right? And they, like, bringing the rabbit for her to eat. And just this sudden feeling of jealousy as well, which comes across because you notice that he's, you know, he doesn't want anyone else bringing rabbits for her to eat. Like, there's no need for her to indebt herself to anyone else, I think he says, right? There's, you know, he'll sort the rabbits out. That's his job. So I think you're right. I think there is something there, but it's almost like they have to look for approval. They almost have to check that actually this is real. And the only way they can check this is real is if they have some common feature.
So, final question. Do you think there's anything that the philosophy of love could learn from this film?
Yeah, I think there's a lot that we could pay attention to. So I've pulled out a couple of themes which I think are worth exploring, but there's many more. So particularly for the philosophy of love, I think there's something worth thinking about, sort of the conditions that are conducive to love appearing. There are some interesting contrasts that are really made a lot of between sort of the hotel and then sort of the loners living in the wood, and how sort of the hotel that is set up in order for love to actually happen, to try and give these poor single souls one last chance before they turn into animals. You have to wear the same clothes, you have to do these same activities, you have to go through the rituals, go to the dances, listen to the speeches, learn, you know, remind yourself why it's so good to be in a couple and not be single again. And just how sort of forced this is and how awkward all the interactions between the guests are in this sort of a situation, and how this clearly is not going to end up with you know, love. It's not conducive to it, and yet that's exactly what they're striving for. Whereas in contrast, you've then got this, and you got pushed out into the loners community, and you know, where you can't fall in love, where you're not allowed to do that, and yet it's way more conducive to actually finding love, because you get to be your individual self, you're taught to be independent, so you actually sort of, you know, learn who you are and to fend for yourself. You're not dependent on others, and yet this allows you to, you know, see the other people for who they are, and that is much more conducive to finding who this other person is. So those two contrasts really strike me when I'm watching.
Is that something about the nature of love then, that it's a response to individuals as they are, rather than looking for some common property or defining trait that you might share with a particular person?
I think so, yeah. And that's something that's really hard to define and actually pin down and try and, you know, write about or put into a theory. But I think there is definitely something about finding out what that other person is as a whole that is a, something that, yeah, really is a part of love.
Yeah, I can see the difficulty, because if you're looking for something to validate these things, so, oh, I'm in love with this person, or am I in love with this person? Then you can see the temptation to look for something that could shore that up or validate it. And it'd be nice if you could tick some box, right? Ah, shares a defining trait. But if actually what love is in part a kind of just a felt response to another person, then it's going to be harder or less clear.
I think just a lot less clear, right? And it'll leave a lot more room open for doubt, which is scary as a human being, right? If you're looking for love or relationship with someone else, like not being sure that it's going to work, that's scary. That's vulnerable making, right? You're suddenly putting yourself in a position where you've got to trust the other and trust that your judgment was right. Yeah, so if you've got that tick box to check, then that's going to be a very tempting thing to cling on to, check that you've got it right. But I don't think we have that in the real world.
Before, you said there were two things that the philosophy of love could learn from the film. So the first one was just thinking about conditions that are conducive for love occurring or appearing. But I wonder what the second one was.
So the second one is, I mean, it's certainly linked to the philosophy of love, but perhaps linked a little bit more to think about sort of society in general and sort of social norms. So this was thinking about how much that romantic relationship and romantic couple relationship is just so valorized in the film. It's just seen as so important. Like, this is the thing that matters in your life. If you don't do this thing, then you have basically failed, right? You have to try and find it again or you're done. Like, there's no point in you being around anymore. You may as well be turned into an animal. And I think this is actually the thing that is the most true about the film. It sounds like the most ridiculous thing, but I think this is where it's a real comment on the current way that we actually as a society focus on romance and the romantic relationship at the expense of other good, loving relationships that we have. It's like, for instance, in the film, right, there's still relationships, like, for instance, the leader has with her parents, right? Clearly, there is a relationship there, but that's not good enough, right? Relationships with your parents don't count. They're not valuable enough. They're not meaningful enough. Friendships, right, the best friend friendship in the... I mean, that's a questionable best friendship, I think, in the film, is the two girls, the one that has the nosebleed and the other film with the, sorry, the other girl with the beautiful hair. Right, that's not good enough either, right? It's not good enough to have a best friend. You have to have a romantic partner that you love, and that not only do you have to have a romantic partner, that romantic relationship has to fit a mold that is accepted by society. It has to be one that meets this requirement that you have these common defining factors. And so I think that is, I mean, maybe it's not as blatantly obvious, or maybe it's certainly not quite as weird, but there's a real element of truth in that we do put these relationships on a pedestal. And we certainly have, in history and continue to do so, have sort of social rules about what these relationships should look like, whether that is that they should be heterosexual rather than homosexual, whether they should be couples rather than polyamorous. So we're starting to talk about these things and break some of these assumptions and norms down. And what I think this film really shows is, look, you need to be aware of what those assumptions are and perhaps just how ridiculous they are. And are they things that are really worth holding on to that much that you're actually, you know, you have to die if you don't manage to meet these norms and expectations. So there's a philosopher called Elizabeth Brake who talks about marriage, and is sort of, you know, worries about having an institution of marriage that we currently have, because she thinks it contributes to this in some sense, sort of it enforces the norms and expectations around romantic love that we have. And she's coined the term amateur normativity for this valorization of romantic relationships, for thinking that this is the thing that you should strive for, and that you have somehow lost out if you don't find it in your life.
That's fascinating. So is the thought that these relationships are perhaps overvalued, or that we kind of emphasize the importance of them because your life is seen as a kind of a failure if you're not in a romantic relationship, regardless of whatever else is going on in your life or whatever other loving relationships you have in your life? And on that, I'm with you, and I'm certainly with you in thinking that we shouldn't be turning anyone into animals or killing them if they're not in a romantic relationship. But I was wondering, so normativity is just about value. And if we think that romantic relationships are good, then we're just going to want to make normative claims about them, right? That it's good for people to be in them and perhaps encourage people to pursue them. So, I don't know, let's think that, like, exercise is a good thing. And if that's true, then aren't there just going to be a bunch of normative claims surrounding that? We're going to recommend that people exercise and say, hey, look, you should probably get regular exercise and so on and so forth. So if something's valuable, aren't there just going to be normative claims associated with it?
No, I think this is a really helpful way to bring out the point. So there's, yeah, clearly it's good to exercise, but what we wouldn't do is say, well, it's good to exercise, therefore you must play volleyball. Because what we're saying is, like, well, it's fine to say that romantic relationships are valuable, that love is valuable, that it's a good thing to look for. But the problem is then saying, and so you must have a romantic couple relationship that fits these norms. Whereas what you should be saying is, look, love is a great thing. Go and find it. You could go and cultivate a friendship with lots of different people. You could go and be polyamorous. You could go and have a romantic couple relationship if you want to, or you could focus on the relationship you have with your siblings or your family members. Because look, you're getting love from all of these different places. Just as you can exercise by running, swimming, dancing, and doing all of these different things, you're still managing to access the good just in a variety of different ways. And you're actually stopping people from accessing it by sort of restricting. So no, you can only get your exercise through volleyball. And then you have people that hate volleyball or can't play volleyball, and they're restricted from being able to get to that good. And so the worry is here that we're restricting people from being able to access these valuable relationships from being able to actually get the good of love, because we are prescribing the way that you should do it.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And I like the analogy. So there's nothing wrong with volleyball. If you want to play volleyball, it's a good way of getting exercise. But there are other ways of getting exercise. And anyone who is, you know, insists that you have to play volleyball is being kind of like unhelpfully prescriptive and narrow. But I do wonder if there is something slightly different about romantic love. Because, yeah, you know, we don't write poems and make movies and songs and write novels and our hearts don't bleed for volleyball. And it seems that there is something distinctive about romantic love, right?
Yeah, so I think there's, you made an important distinction there, right there. So there can be differences in sort of how much something is valuable, or it could just be that you've got sort of a different kind of thing, a different kind of version of something that is in general valuable. So I certainly agree with you that I think romantic love is a distinct thing. I think it's very hard to actually pin down what makes it distinct. But there is definitely something there about it, that it's unique, that it's special in some way, and it's certainly very tempting to think that. But I think that has to be tempered with a realization that it's also a very risky thing. It makes us very vulnerable, and that for some people, perhaps, it's just not worth the risk. And so perhaps they might think a different kind of love is more valuable for them. And so I think I'm sort of persuaded by that it's distinct, but perhaps not as more valuable as we might be tempted to think, even though we have this temptation to only talk about this one kind of love.
What you said there reminds me of something that Natasha McKeever said in the first podcast we did for the series, when she was talking about Phantom Thread.
And she brings up Annette Bayer, doesn't she, and sort of the riskiness of love, yeah.
Yeah, Annette Bayer's paper, Unsafe Love, which we provided a link to after that podcast, and we'll provide a link to again. You also mentioned Elizabeth Brakesworth on amateur normativity, and hopefully we'll provide a link to that too.
Yeah, her book's Minimising Marriage, where she develops that idea.
Cool. I will try and link her work, and perhaps also one of your responses to it.
Yeah.
Just finally, is there anything that we kind of didn't cover that you were hoping to say or add?
No, I think we've pretty much covered everything. I just love how that it ends up being a love story after being sort of such a cynical critique of everything to do with love.
Yeah, that's a nice idea. I'll try and run that by my mum next time. And yeah, thanks so much for coming on, Alison. This was really great to chat with you.
Thanks very much for having me. Great to chat about it.
The Philosophy and Film podcast was edited by Ollie Jenkins with music from Nathan Mosley. It's a Hyde Park Picture House production. Thanks again to this week's guest, Alison, for taking the time to speak with us. If you're enjoying the series and listening via a podcast app, don't forget to subscribe and to rate the show as well. Any positive ratings are hugely appreciated as they help us to reach more people, so thanks. For our next episode, we'll be joined by Professor Bob Stern from the University of Sheffield for a discussion about the suitably post-apocalyptic survival film, The Road. But until then, stay safe and thanks for listening. Thank you.